Welcome to Writer's Sun Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are streaming live at kuci.org. Today is July 17th, 2020. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You can find past shows on iTunes and Stitcher, and this one will go up in a few days as well. So please do subscribe, and when we upload a new show, it will arrive in your podcast file. And if you need to reach us, email penonfire@earthlink.net. We love to hear from you. Before we get started, I should say that the opinions and views are not those of the University of California Regents, but they're our views, and we hope you love them. Today, my guest is poet Kim Dower. Kim has published 4 collections of poetry, all with Red Hen Press. Her most recent book, Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave, just won the Gold Ippy Award for Best Poetry Collection from an indie press in 2019. Kim was City Poet Laureate of West Hollywood from October 2016 to October 2018. Her poems are included in several anthologies, notably Wide Awake, Poets of Los Angeles and Beyond, published by Beyond Baroque Books, Pacific Coast Poetry Series. She teaches poetry and dreaming in the BA program of Antioch University and Wake Up Your Prose for UCLA Extension. Welcome back to the show, Kim.
Thank you, Barbara. It's always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you, too. And you've been on a few times, and I think you were on with this current book and with maybe all the others, too. And that's no reason to not have you back again. Because I love your stuff. And even if you were not my friend, if I found your book in a bookstore without knowing who you were, I would still love it. I just think it's just been interesting watching your evolution as a poet and how your writing just becomes stronger all the time. And so I wanted to picture a little Kim, like as a kid, did you read poetry? Did your parents read poetry to you?
It just makes me laugh to picture Kim as a little kid because I think as we get older and older, those times seem so far away. And I think of myself as that little girl, and I don't really recognize her or remember her. And then at the same time, I feel exactly the way she is. it's a weird combination of mixing memory with the moment, which is a lot of what my poetry does, actually. My mother read to me all the time, for which I'm very grateful. And I loved rhyming. I loved Dr. Seuss, for example. Mm-hmm. Just thrilled every time, I wanted her to read over and over and over. And just the music of the words and the silliness and the imagination, I just couldn't get enough of it. And, I've talked about this before, but my grandmother was Russian, and she could read, but she couldn't write in English, which I actually didn't know for a long, long time. But she would recite to me Pushkin poems in Russian, and I didn't know what she was saying, but the music of the poetry was just mesmerizing. And I think that really influenced me. I wish I could read it in Russian, but I can't.
So then, as you went along, you're in school, you're in high school, you go to college. I mean, talk a little bit about just how this all happened, because, I met you years ago when you were doing PR for, I think it was T. Jefferson Parker. Maybe that might have been our first contact years ago when I started my show, and you were and still are a publicist, a book publicist. And so, how did that happen, and how did poetry continue to happen for you?
Yeah, well, I am certainly still a publicist for authors because I do love doing that, and also poets have to earn a living. So I think that when you, for poets, you have a choice of either becoming an academic and going that life and teaching and earning your living writing and well, teaching, because poets don't make a lot of money writing poetry, as you've probably heard. So, you know, or you go into the real world and you have a job doing something else that's not poetry. And we all know, you know, William Carlos Williams was a pediatrician and Wallace Stevens sold insurance and so on and on. But I always loved to write poetry as a child and throughout school. And it was just a fun thing to do, right? And it wasn't until I got to college, my very first year at college, there was an elective course one could take called Introduction to Creative Writing Poetry. And, you know, I was 17 years old and in Boston, and the teacher was a young man named Thomas Lux, who became a very, very famous poet, sadly passed away recently. But it was that class that made me realize that poetry was something one could do one's whole life. I mean, once I started writing poetry in that class, that was it. I knew the power that poetry had, both writing it and reading it, that it was transformative and exciting and opened me up to all kinds of imaginations and thoughts. So I wrote very seriously all through college. When I graduated from Emerson, I taught Introduction to Creative Writing, and I did that for 3 years. But I have to say that writing poetry and teaching poetry and being in that atmosphere at that time felt very constricting and restrictive, and I wanted to see a little bit more of the world and do other things. At that time, there wasn't a lot of poetry for women either. The two great poets, Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, back then both killed themselves. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, I sure don't want to end up in Boston, you know, killing myself. So I mean, that's sort of funny, but it's also kind of true. There was a darkness about it that I wasn't comfortable with. So I moved to Los Angeles, you know, the land of the sun and the light and the possibilities, and I stopped writing poetry. I started writing other things, and I started my business. I got married and had a baby, and I always felt like something was missing. And I would write on little scraps of paper, and I had notebooks, and I would put them away and find them years later, as a matter of fact. But I really felt like something was missing and I couldn't get it back until my son was about to go off to college. And I felt this deep longing, and I already started missing him. And bingo, I wrote a poem. And it was at that time that I didn't stop writing the poems, and they started coming out faster and faster. I'd write sometimes two a day. And when I had about 20 or 30 poems, I got back in touch with Tom Lux after all those years. He was then teaching in Atlanta. And I wrote him an email and I said, hey, you know, I'm starting to write poetry again, and I don't know if I've got anything happening here. And he wrote back and he said, well, the warranty has expired, but, which was hilarious, but, you know, send me a few poems. So I did. And he said, you know, Kim, you still have what you had back then, but you've got to get back to the craft, and you've got to get back to line breaks and all the things that make up a poem. And he suggested I go to the poetry festival, the Palm Beach Poetry Festival in Florida, and the Sarah Lawrence Summer Workshop. So I did. I became a workshop enthusiast, and I did as many poetry workshops in as many places as I could in a very concentrated amount of time. And that's the story. Probably too long a story, Barbara, but there you go.
Yeah, that's a good story. But I love how you, you know, how you talk about going to workshops and, you know, that the craft was important, because I think, you know, poetry looks simple and can be simple to just write. It's not like, you know, writing a novel or maybe even an essay or short story where you need some kind of something, you know, structures, some kind of instruction to even really understand. Whereas poetry, we kind of feel it's this thing we've always had, you know, from children's books and from, you know, our childhood, we bring it with us, but there's such a craft to it that I think, you know, people who are starting to write poetry or who become, or who think they're poets, kind of overlook the craft of it because they think it's, you know, it should be more natural, or it's, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I'm making sense, but.
Yeah, no, you're making total sense. I mean, there's everybody, all of us who write in our journals and who want to get our feelings out and the emotions and all of this, which is great. And it can often be the impetus for a poem and be a prompt and get us going. But a poem is really something that is built. You build a poem, and it can start with an observation, and it can start with a first line or something that you really need to get out to make sense of. But then after that part, that's the fun part, and that is a lot of fun. But then you have to build it. You have to take it apart. What leaves, what stays, the music of it, reading it aloud. And I mean, these are things you know well, Barbara, because we've been in classes together, and you see how much goes into this. It's like a puzzle, and you're not ever sure quite if it's finished, but then one day the poem just gets up and walks off your desk and says, I never want to see you again. And either, you know, that's like a really good sign that the poem doesn't need you anymore. Poem's finished. But, you know, sometimes it can take 10 drafts and sometimes 100, but the poem is put together with a lot of thought and effort. And yeah.
Well, let's talk about one of your poems that I just love so much. Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave. I think it was Rattle sent it out as one of their daily poems some time ago. Letter to My Son.
Oh.
A 92. Yeah. Can you read that to us and then talk about the process of writing it?
Sure. So this is actually a prose poem, which simply means that there are no line breaks. What makes a poem different from prose is that it has line breaks, and the line breaks signify a pause or music or enjambment, which is when the next line is a surprise, doesn't follow necessarily. The prose poem is still a poem in that it's concise and it says as much as it can in as few words as it can, and it's musical, but it does not employ line breaks. So, and this is a letter, actually. Letter to My Son. Dementia runs in the family, so if I can't think of a name or a place, a moment everyone else can vividly recall, I feel afraid, useless, ashamed. You see, I don't want anyone to carry me into another room so I can get a view of a tree or remind me what a tree is or tell me what I'm sipping from is called a straw. I've seen it all before. My grandfather didn't know he was eating a banana, only that someone had to peel it for him, and that thing, that peel, had to be thrown away. I'm not saying it's certain I will have dementia, but if I do, please know this. I won't be mad if you don't take care of me. I won't even know that you're not. Tell me everything's okay and I will believe you. Tell me there's a bird on a branch outside my window, even if there is no window, and I will imagine he's singing to me. Once, when a storm was coming, my mother looked up at the sky, told me God was punching the clouds to make rain pour out. She never even believed in God. The point is this: I may not know exactly who you are when you come to visit. I may be confused. But when I hold your hand, it will all come back in waves. Rocking you in my arms when you were a baby, your little seltzer voice, my heart flooding my body with joy every morning you jumped in my bed. I will not be angry like some people with dementia can get. I've never been good at angry. I will not peel the yellow paper off the wall or bite my caregiver. Play a few rounds of blackjack with me. You deal. I will smile each time I get a picture card. Tell me I've hit 21, even if I bust. Use real chips, have party drinks with ice that clinks, a cocktail napkin with which to dab my lips.
Oh, thank you. I love this. And it's so you. It's funny. It's bittersweet. It's so emotional. Talk about writing it. I mean, how did it begin? Did it come out, just in one sweep onto the page, or what happened?
Barbara, this is one of those poems that's like a blackout poem. I call them blackout poems. It doesn't mean that I was, under the influence when I wrote it, but I mean, I was under the influence when I wrote it, but not alcohol, but something occasionally will come over me and I'll just, as you say, it comes out in one piece, and it's almost like someone's talking the poem to me or through me. And this is one of those poems. I have other ones where I can tell you how hard I work to change or make something happen, or the challenges I had writing it, but this is not one of those poems. All I can tell you is I remember feeling very sad and feeling scared about dementia. I don't know what had happened, but then I thought, I have only one child and he'll be stuck with it. I was very much involved with my mother, with my mother's illness, and it's very scary. And she did get angry, and she got angry at caregivers, and it was unpleasant and frightening and sad. So I had a moment, and I just wrote this out.
Mm. Well, let's talk about one that you did have trouble with, or that it did take a lot of finagling to get it right. And I don't know if that's one you mentioned earlier pre-radio, but I mean before, when we were talking about different poems, the one in was it Last Train to the Missing Planet?
I mentioned to you, I mean it's another poem actually about my son, it is the hardest poem that I ever wrote. I can, when you asked me to think about that, this came right away to me, because first of all, it took months and months and months because it just wasn't right. And I learned a lot about the process of writing when I was writing this poem. Mm. So the poem is called Fontanelle. And Fontanelle is, when you're born, it's the part of your skull, it's the last part that forms when we're born, the little tender spot right above your brain, right under your skull. And so I'll read the poem and then I'll talk about it.
Okay.
Bucknell. He's so lucky, the brain doctors tell me, huddled in white, their names embroidered in blue script across their chests. My grown son sprawled across the hospital bed, tubes, needles, sticking into his body, twined around him like veins through a parched leaf. I can't look at him, his mouth crusted, unfocused eyes that yesterday lit up the room, now his skull fractured. Same head I used to hold in one hand, his legs rocking my arms to sleep. Infants' heads are so soft, easy to rupture, brains still forming. I can't look at him now, his giant hands, filth baked under his nails from scratching the gutter where he fell off the back of a car. Of course he shouldn't have been sitting on the trunk of a car, but you see, they will do things. They will do things that can hurt, and we have to watch. And when I see him in that bed hooked up to machines, beeping instructions to the nurse, making noise like garbage trucks on collection day, I have to look away, cover my eyes like he did when he was three, afraid to see the flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz. He'd run screaming into my lap. Where is it now, the Emerald City? Where can I get the courage to uncover my eyes, see the blood ooze from his ear, walk over to the bed, whisper, I'm here, it'll be okay. You're lucky, the doctors say, but all I can think is what if it hadn't gone this way? Luck, this slippery slope of miracles, unpredictable, fragile as the fontanelle, soft luck. Running out from the moment we're born.
Thank you. Yeah, wow.
Right, yeah.
I remember this when you had to go back east. He was back east. Is that where it happened? Or maybe that was another ailment or
that was another
or something.
Children, this is what happens. There's things, right? And no, this was out here. This was in Los Angeles. But I think it was the hardest to write because, you know, this poem is not from my imagination. I wish it was. But it was from a situation that happened, and he's fine. And this was, you know, a while ago now. But part of why we write poetry, I believe, and also why we read it, is to sort out, is to put order into chaos, to try to understand the inexplicable, and to be comforted by trying to understand it. So writing this poem was to try to be comforted, to try to understand, to try to put this situation in order that I could not deal with in any other way except for to write a poem. And you can't hear it when I'm reading it, but the poem is written in quatrains, which is stanzas with four lines each. So on the page, the poem looks very orderly and very neat. And I learned writing it that also the poem will tell you the order it wants to be in. It will tell you if it doesn't want any stanza breaks or how the break should be, if it's couplets, or it kind of knows how it wants to look. And that's part of the process of making sense of what you're writing about. And I changed this order so many times, and it just took months to write this poem.
Did you have to be a distance away from the experience to write, or were you making notes, writing anything during the experience?
I don't remember. I wish I could tell you. I'm sure that I There were details about the doctors and, you know, being in the ICU and all that. I probably either wrote it, I don't think I was writing anything down during that time. I think it was just a matter of being there, but the memories came back, but I did have to keep putting this poem aside and coming back to it. Yeah. And I did take it at the time I was still going to the Palm Beach Poetry Festival, and I'd written many drafts, and I took it there and did it in a, read it in a workshop, and the people in that workshop were so incredibly helpful, because I didn't want anything sentimental in the poem, and there were still things that, you know, were came out of just sentiment, and I needed to toughen the poem up, and I needed to give it more muscle. Because you want your poems to be read and enjoyed by other people. They're not just for you to remember something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but what would be an example, do you think, of sentiment? Do you remember anything that was in here that was that you had to cut or change?
You know, the Wizard of Oz part where I had, where he was afraid to see the flying monkeys in the Wizard of Oz, he'd run screaming. There were some people I remember who said, you know, you might think about taking that out because there was sort of a sentimental feeling to that. Mm-hmm. I chose to leave it in because I felt like it showed the image of how he was as a child, that those monkeys scared him, and that I want, and that the idea of where can I get the courage was the idea of, you know, the lion in the Wizard of Oz. I like the references to that. So there was a choice. Of course, writing a poem is all about choices, what we leave in, what we take out. But I think that there might have been other things that I had in there that were sentimental in a way that wasn't working. But I do remember that. That idea, and where is it now? The Emerald City might have been something to come out. You know, the other thing is I had to wait for this poem to kind of mature and grow in a way so that I could read it aloud without crying.
Yeah.
And if that's an interesting thing about a poem, if it's still too close to you, that it makes you cry, you need to either wait, or I do, or it's not ready yet to go out into the world. Hmm. I mean, laughing is a different thing, because I've written poems that make me laugh, you know, when I'm writing them or when I'm reading them, and that's okay. I feel like, you know, if I still think it's funny, or if I smile, you know, as I'm still working on it, I think that's fine. But crying is not a good thing.
It's interesting. Sorry. Yeah.
Not good.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM. I'm with Kim Dower. We're talking about her poetry. Her latest book is Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave. The book she just read from is Last Train to the Missing Planet. And all of her collections are with Red Hen Press. So you talked about the Palm Beach Poetry Festival, helping with that poem. How do you critique poetry? I mean, what is useful? Because I think the way poetry is critiqued is sort of different from how you critique fiction or even memoir. You know, I think it's sort of a different process, or what is useful may be different. I don't know. What do you think?
I think so. Absolutely. I mean, because poetry is so much involved in craft, and there are so many different lenses that you have to look at a poem with or through. I don't know about prose, and I, in terms of critiquing it, I would imagine Well, I would imagine there are a lot of similar elements, and you want to get rid of all cliches. You know, have you seen this before many times? You know, how can you say something in a new way? Is this as fresh as you can make it? Is this as clear as you can make it? All of those things obviously are true in both poetry and prose, but poetry is, as we know, or been taught, the most concise form of language. So you don't have a lot of time to say what you need to say. The idea is as trim as you can make it, as precise as you can make it. And the lenses that one looks through are, one of the lenses is music, which is why we must read our poems aloud. When we're writing them, when we're finished with them, we have to hear what they sound like. And immediately when we read a poem aloud that we're working on, we'll know, we'll hear right away what's wrong, what sounds bulky, what word we've already used. We'll hear the music. And so that's one of the lenses. Another lens, it are the line breaks. Line breaks are there to signal, as I said before, a pause or a change, a moment. A poem has the chance to do things, I believe, that prose doesn't have the chance to do. So when you critique a poem in a workshop, and there are different kinds of workshops, you know, I've been to workshops where people immediately say, oh, you know, I'd get rid of that whole last stanza. It's not doing you any good. It's just weighing it down. You know, and then there are workshops where you're not allowed to make any kind of a reference like that. It's more a suggestion, or have you thought about, or what if. But when we're looking at a poem in a workshop, I think the most important thing first is to hear the meanings that people take from your poem. Because a poem can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And is that what you as a poet want? If you have a specific meaning you're trying to get at and no one sees that, that is a red flag. Maybe you need to go back and build that poem some more.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things. Some poems are just about language and the way things sound, and they don't necessarily have to have a meaning per se. You know, I always say that a good poem is about one thing and then it's about the other thing, you know, the layers underneath the very obvious, right? And so how do people, what are the meanings that people take from the poem, and is that what you want to hear? And also, are you saying things in the freshest way? That's key to a poem. Get rid of the cliches, get rid of what you've heard already. And, you know, I don't think I'm going to be going to a workshop for a while, because I'm no longer interested in sort of a collaboration of a poem, because everyone will have something different to say. And sometimes that's very useful. And you take notes about the different things people say, and then you can go back to your poem and you can think about it. But now these days, I've been sending my poem to just a couple of people whom I trust, who will cut right to the chase, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
I remember a while ago, you said something, I forget where it was, but you said something to the effect of, you know, you like to write poems, you like to write a poem and then stick a lie in it. Right? I mean, you said that, right?
Yeah, it sounds like me. It sounds like I was lying when I said it. So
I mean, just that poems are not autobiographical necessarily.
Correct.
I mean, people maybe, you know, think maybe because of journal writing or something that readers may think, oh, you know, everything in here is what this poet has lived through, but right. Probably not.
Definitely not. I hope not. I mean, you know, it's like people do think they're autobiographical because the emotions are so intense. And what we really want is, you know, to save and to protect and punctuate the emotional value of the poem, but make everything else up. So it's the emotions that we want to convey, but not necessarily the exact situation or truth. And, you know, people think they're autobiographical because they feel true because the emotions are true. Mm-hmm. But most of my poems begin with something real. Obviously, it's a real feeling or something I've seen, and then veer away and just really make it all up. You know, you also had asked me about persona, you know, to think about my poems that and persona is when you take on the traits or the personality or the head of somebody else and you write through that person. And great persona poems, you know, a woman writing about, you know, through a man's voice or whatever, which is of course what fiction writers do all the time. They create characters and who aren't themselves. Well, again, my poems are pretty much all in persona. You know, I heard Billy Collins say that he writes through persona, but he just try, his persona is like the better version of himself. Uh-huh. Which is very interesting, the better version of himself. I think mine is the worst version of myself. No, I think that I steal a lot of things. I do things that, you know, I get away with things. And, you know, that's not what I'm doing in real life. My persona is sort of the bad Kim in a way, or, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's where your imagination comes in, right? I mean,
Well, do you have a favorite poem in Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave? Do you have favorite poems of your own?
I do have some favorite poems. I'm going to go back. I'll read one from, I'll read two short ones from Sunbathing, but okay. I want to go back to the, mixing persona.
Okay.
A lie, lies, and a poem that begins with a first line. The title is the first line. Mm-hmm. And I truly love this poem, if I'm allowed to say that I love a poem of mine. And I particularly love it because it's the first poem in my first book. So this poem is actually from Air Kissing on Mars.
Okay.
And so it starts with the truth, and then you'll see bad persona Kim, and it's called They Took the Mailbox Away. Mm-hmm. And it is also the first line of the poem is the title. They took the mailbox away on Cahuenga and Clinton. I know because I wasn't feeling right, decided to take a walk, figure things out, remember why I love the clouds. Found my rent check still in my purse, gave me a goal, a project I could complete. But when I got to the corner, it was gone. Just space in the place where the box had been, where I've deposited countless bills, birthday cards, where once I tossed a sticky, half-eaten ice cream dish. There was no garbage can in sight. I gave it some serious thought, but now realize the mess I made may have destroyed a young girl's last letter to her grandmother, stained a college application. What did admissions people think when it arrived with chocolate sprinkles stuck to the stamps? Worse yet, a love letter someone finally had the guts to send, smeared with butterscotch sauce, possibly obscuring the recipient's address. Sender, never knowing, it was not received. When I saw the empty corner where the mailbox used to be, granted out of place on that isolated street, It hit me, the lives I ruined, the mailman's soiled hands.
All right.
Got it? See?
I'm glad that you never threw ice cream. Well, did you? Did you?
No. And you know, Barbara, I mean, this was, I would read this at, you know, at the readings when this book came out, and people would ask me when they were getting the book signed, God, did you really put ice cream in the mailbox? And then I realized people think what you write in your poems are true.
Yeah.
So I remember walking down that street, Cahuenga and Clinton, ready to mail stuff, and the mailbox was gone, and it was horrifying to me that this mailbox was just disappeared. And I do remember sitting on the curb and writing, because I always have a little notebook with me. And if I don't, you know, you can dictate into your phone. It's fabulous. You can dictate into the notes section and then email it to yourself, which I do a lot now. But I remember, you know, writing this down. This poem took a long time to write, but it came from what was true, what was upsetting to me. And then, you know, the ice cream and all the other things were obviously, you know, made up to make a point, you know. Mm-hmm. So, all right, so here's a poem from Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave. It's a short poem, and again, it starts with a real situation and then veers away. It's called Unruly Aura. The cashier at the health food store tells me I have a beautiful aura. Wait, I tell her. If you want to see a really beautiful aura, wait until I've taken my Renew Life Ultimate Flora probiotic. After that, my aura will knock your socks off. She smiles at me and rings me up. My money has a beautiful aura, too. My dollar bills float out of my pink wallet. The man behind me swells from the heat I generate. Each step I take brings me closer to God, the final, fabulous aura. Take my hand, I tell her. Squeeze my aura. It's hungry and looking for someone to devour.
That's great.
So, I mean, I bet you can tell me what's true and what's not true in that poem.
I believe you went to the health food store.
I did.
The rest of it, I'm not sure. I bet she told you you had a beautiful aura.
She did tell me that.
And the rest, I don't know.
Well, you know, I go to the health food store to get my Renew Life Ultimate Flora probiotic. And I love the name of that. I love the name of products. And a lot of times I write them down in the hopes that I'll be using them soon. But it all came together because, you know, the cashier, they're supposed to tell you things like you have a beautiful aura. So you'll make sure to go back every single time and get something else you don't need for a price that's, you know, ridiculous. So, I mean, she told me I had a beautiful aura, and I smiled, and I just thought to myself, that is such, you know what. And then I went in the parking lot, and I started to write this poem. Hmm. But, of course, my dollar bills didn't float out of my wallet.
Did the guy swell behind you?
I really don't know, Barbara. You know, these are things you don't really want to know about. I actually, there was no man behind me. So, and here's the complete lie. This is a tiny little poem, and I really don't know where it came from. And it's called "She Never Trusted Happiness." Mm-hmm. Maybe it was something her mother said one morning as the young girl dipped her donut into a glass of whole milk. Powdered sugar still on her lips, her mother tells her, "Don't get used to this."
I was going to ask you about that one. I love that. And I also love that it's so short too. You know, it's like poems can be short, right?
Yeah, I love that it's short. I wish I could write more of those. They're really hard. And I love to read short ones. When I write a short one, I feel like I need to go buy myself a gift. I'm so excited when I can write a short poem that works.
You know, go ahead.
No, go, tell me.
Well, I was going to say, you know, we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to talk just briefly about, because on the show we try to talk about the business of writing when we can, and so I was thinking, you know, the business of writing poetry, is that an anachronism, or was poetry never thought of as a way to make business, to make money, to, you know, to be more than sort of, you know, a hobby or just to create high art? And so I continued to think about that and wondered if you could talk about, for a poet who wants to break in, I mean, are journals a good way to go? Or contests a good way to go? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I listen, and break into what? I mean, it's like breaking into a bank that has no money. You know, I mean, like, you know,
well, break into publication, maybe, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really sad thing, because you are, you know, on the one hand, you're working your butt off trying to make these poems work and be the best that they can be, and you're not getting paid for it. And so it's sort of an oxymoron or whatever, but you need another job, you need a career, you need to do something else. Fine. So that's the way that is. And unless, like I say, you go the academic route, that's the way it's going to be for poets in this country. There are a few that actually do make money. And that's great. There should be more. But if you want to break in, as you say, to the world of being read and have people enjoy your work and resonate with it and all these wonderful, exciting things, and have people say, "God, I read that and I really understand and I felt it." And yes, there's a ton of opportunity now for poets. Never before has there been so many opportunities. And journals, online journals, contests. I mean, definitely I would suggest getting a copy of Poets and Writers magazine, because it comes out every 2 months, and in every issue of Poets and Writers in the back, there's a list of all the contests and all the journals and all the places to send to. And they even have an insert, like a calendar that you can fold out that gives you the deadlines, and you can hang it up on your wall, which is what I used to do. I used to keep a big loose leaf notebook and cut out all the things from Poets and Writers, the journals, the magazines, the deadlines, and put them in a book, and then check off when I had sent stuff in. So yes, everyone should be writing and sending out all the time.
Have you ever seen the book Max Makes a Million by Myra Coleman?
I have. I adore it.
I love that book. It's about a dog that wants to be a poet, moved to Paris, and his agent gets him $1 million book deal.
Right. I love it. I love it. I love her. I love her drawings.
Yes. Yeah.
I always think, God, I would love her to illustrate my poems. That's what I think. Yeah, I adore her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a great book. I think I did buy it before I had a son, and I bought it for me. I'm like, this is such a cool book. This is hopeful.
Well, all her books are beautiful. And the book she wrote about mother's closet and the dresses. Oh, God, they're magnificent.
Her cookbook. All of them.
Oh, yes. And, you know, look, in terms of money and writing, people do not, or I hope not, I don't think so, choose writing, any kind of writing, because they want to make money. I think that writing is something that we do when we have to do it. It's not a choice we make in a lot of cases. I mean, you know, you make the choice to become a doctor and go to medical school, and I don't think you're born thinking I have to be a doctor. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Forgive me to any doctor listening who's like, oh, hey, I knew at 8 years old I was going to be a doctor, or a lawyer, or you know, a trapeze artist. But I think poetry and writing, most people start out doing that when they're young and know that that's what they want to do and don't think about the money. Mm-hmm. You know, there are writers who make money and writers who don't, but I don't think that it has anything to do with who loves it more.
Yeah, I agree. And yet, I mean, there can be perks, right? Like, I imagine you were poet laureate for West Hollywood for a couple of years. There must have been some wonderful perks to that, right? That were not.
Yeah. I had a
money related, but you know.
Well, they sent me a complete. Yeah, I mean, I was about to just tell you a bunch of lies, but they sent me a complete wardrobe and a whole. New appliances for the kitchen. And but no, I mean, look, the perks were, it was an honor. And you know, feeling like your work makes a difference to people, that's an honor. And that just makes you feel good that your work makes a difference, that you're helping people to create things for themselves. I had the chance to teach workshops at the West Hollywood Library, to go to schools, to talk to, oh my God, a fifth grade class. I can't even tell you what it's like to have fifth graders do automatic writing to prompts and hear their work before they're afraid to have their images read, before they know what makes sense or what doesn't make sense. It was the most amazing experience to hear these people, these children. And to be able to get people excited about poetry, reading it and writing it, that was a perk. And it perked me up, I'll tell you that, because it made me feel what I was doing was important. And, you know, as we know, it's not just money that makes you feel important. Money's great, no question about that, but feeling good about what you do and getting people excited about it and having them do it is a great feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure is. What poets do you love? Who do you read currently?
Well, I love, you know, I have sort of the old ones and the new ones. And, you know, I started way back when loving Frank O'Hara was probably my favorite poet. He's from the New York school. I come from New York. I could really relate. To his conversational style, which, you know, I use a lot in my own poems, the dialogue, he used to say writing a poem should be like making a phone call. You know, he wrote in the 60s and he wrote a book called Lunch Poems, which
I
are just.
I have that one, yeah.
Oh, well, you know, reread that poem. You know, they're all poems that he wrote during his lunch hour, and he worked at the Museum of Modern Art. He was a curator for the museum and an art critic. And he used to walk down 57th Street, which is one of my favorite streets in New York, and write these poems. So Frank O'Hara, and then very different poet, but William Carlos Williams, who, you know, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow. And I just loved, he taught me about the conciseness of language and the music. And, you know, I loved him, and I loved Anne Sexton. These are the early, you know, her honesty and the way she wrote about her feelings and the startling imagery, and I just adored her. I loved Erica Jong's poems when I started writing her books, Fruits and Vegetables. And so these are books that I adored. I never really understood Sylvia Plath until I was much older. And I think the anger in her poems was upsetting to me. Now I'm not upset by it. Now I try to study it and see how did she do that? Then, you know, as years went on and the more contemporary poets, I love Kim Adonisio. I love Dorianne Lux. All the surrealists, the poets that taught me, Thomas Lux, any poem of his, I adore, and then I try to study. Stephen Dunn's poems, I love. Oh, yeah. Love him. Bill Knott, K-N-O-T-T, who is an amazing surrealist poet, but the way he uses language and puts words together, incredible. And then I grew to love Sharon Olds. Mm-hmm. And again, the emotions and the beauty of her work. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so many.
Yeah.
So many. Yeah, so many.
So many.
We are drawing down on the end of our time together right here. I wonder if you have any, well, you've had a lot of great tips, offered a lot of great tips and advice for writers, but I don't know, is there anything else that is important to say, to tell writers who may not even be poets, who may be interested in poetry and feel drawn to it? Anything you might want to say to them?
Sure, I want to say that for poets, there's no such thing as writer's block. There doesn't need to be writer's block because there's a poem everywhere if you just look. And I know that sounds maybe kind of like a Hallmark card. If that was in a poem, I'd delete it because it sounds so ridiculous. But whether you're just walking down the street and you overhear a conversation, or you see something that moves you, or I write poems just about parking my car. Anything that we do or see, they took the mailbox away, what have you, keep a notebook with you at all times and write down what strikes you as interesting or funny or something that moves you in any way. Because the poems are living and breathing, they're there, ready for you to like just pick them. And also to remember that a poem is a built thing. A poem is something that we make, and the idea can come quickly, and we can do automatic writing to get all the images out, and then we make it like clay, and that in itself is an amazingly fun, and it's so involved and focused. You know, during this time we're experiencing now with this quarantine pandemic, I can lose myself for hours in just working on one poem. So for people who want to write poems or intrigued by poems, read as many as you can and just give yourself prompts, the beginning of a conversation or something you overhear, because I guarantee you there will be a poem there. And also dreams. I get a lot of poems from dreams. So if you dream, if you're lucky enough to remember a dream, write it down, and there may be a poem living inside that dream.
Mm-hmm. Kim, thank you so much for being here. It's an interesting time, as you said, and lots of things to write about. And I love what you said about keeping a notebook and jotting things down. Thank you so much. Thank
Barbara,
you.
Thank you. Thank you for always inviting me onto your wonderful show. And thank you for all you do for writers and for your own writing, which is also very beautiful. So thank you.
That was Kim Dower. Her books, four books. The latest one is Sunbathing on Tyrone Power's Grave. take a look. And I'm sure she has a website. And stay with us. We will be back next time with more Writers in Writing. Thanks for being here.